Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us all be able to be followers of that Imam and the followers of his son, our Imam, the living Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, ajjalallah ta'ala farajahu al-sharif.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
The period of Imama of Imam al-Askari salamullah alayhi, which is a pretty brief time compared to the rest of the Imams. He's not the youngest to be martyred. Imam al-Jawad was martyred when he was 25. Imam Hasan al-Askari was 28 when he was martyred. However, the time of Imama of the Imam is shorter, much shorter. It's about 5 or 6 years. The rest of the Imams were Imams for a longer period. Imam Hassan for 10 years, Imam Hussein for about 10 years, Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen salawatullah wa salamu alayhi, about 30 years. Some of the Imams more, some of them less, but the least is Imam Hassan al-Askari, about 5 or 6 years of Imama. This was a very crucial time, very critical time, and the efforts and the responsibility of leading the Ummah during this very critical time was with the Imam. There are a number of things that can be said about this period. I will start by, before getting into some of the details of this period and the efforts of Imam Hasan al-Askari and hopefully learning something from that, I would like to encourage us to study, find some way. It is very unfortunate that we, the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, supposedly as we are called, we don't even know who they were. Imam Hasan al-Askari is one of the least known Imams. The rest of the Muslims don't know about him, don't know much about him, if they've even heard his name. That's understandable. We are the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt. He is our 11th Imam. I don't think I will get even a sentence about this Imam, beyond him being the father of the 12th Imam. If we ask brothers and sisters here, who is this Imam? What did he do during his lifetime? Try to get your hands on whatever material you can and try to learn about all of the Imams, this Imam particularly. One of the things we can understand about this period is that the work of the previous Imams in leading the Ummah, especially those who chose to be closer to them, which are referred to as the Shia, as they weren't leaders of only the Shia, but the Shia were the ones who chose to be closer and follow them more carefully. The movement that they led, which was against the tyranny and against the government that was established in the name of the Prophet, in the name of Islam, these were referred to as Khulafa. These rulers were referred to as Khulafa, meaning successors to the Prophet. They were supposedly succeeding and coming and representing the Prophet with all of what they did. It couldn't be further from the truth that, you know, to consider them Khulafa of the Prophet. The Imams were all moving towards removing this system and establishing government of the Ahlul Bayt. This is something that all the Imams were involved in. And that's why all the Imams, including Imam Hasan al-Askari, were martyred. None of them died natural deaths. We have that both as a general statement from the Imams, but specifically, historically, some of the Imams, we can see that there was an assassination attempt. In the case of Imam Hasan al-Askari, it's pretty clear. They poisoned the Imam, and it took effect. It took about 2 weeks to get the Imam down. It started as an illness. It carried on for about 2 weeks, and then the Imam passed after that. And they came and they brought the body of the Imam out from his house in the street, publicly revealing his face, suggesting and trying to tell people, look, he died a natural death. That very act tells you he didn't die a natural death. Anyhow, they were working against the establishment. And during this period, the Imam of the Imam Hassan al-Askari salawatullah wa salamun alayhi, it is clear there's different signs telling us and suggesting that the movement had grown very strong, and that's why they feared the Imam more than the other Imams. Imam al-Jawad was assassinated when he was 25, but he became an Imam when he was 8. If you do the math, that'll be 17 years they put up with the Imam of the Imam, initially trying different tactics, thinking that they can stop the movement of the Ahlul Bayt. They put up with it for 17 years before they got rid of the Imam. Imam al-Hadi, for a longer period of time, he became an Imam at age 8 as well, and he lived, if I remember, approximately in around 50 years, so a longer number of years, and there were different internal fightings amongst the Abbasids at this period. That's why he got a little more time as well, but it was very effective. Imam Hassan al-Askari was only given 5 or 6 years. And we know for a fact that they were trying to make sure they identify if the Imam has a child, to make sure they get rid of him so they can stop the movement. Let me correct a misunderstanding that is common amongst the Shia, which is based on fallacies. It's not based in fact. The fallacy is the understanding, before reading the text, before reading history books, before reading reliable sources, when you hear that they were looking to make sure they identify the child of the Imam so that they can get rid of him from the get-go, people think, well, everybody knew that the 12th Imam is the one that's going to get rid of dhulm and get rid of injustice, so they were afraid of him. That's not true. That's not the case. That's not what they thought. That's not what they knew. Not only did the government not know that, the Shia at the time, for the most part, didn't know that. It's in the books, yes, there's hadith, but I can tell you there's a long list of hadith. Everybody knows, you've heard the name of the hadith book, Al-Kafi, for example. I'm pretty sure everybody's heard the name of that book. But I can quote you loads of hadith that are there. None of you have heard them before, ever. It's there, but it's not common knowledge. There's a difference between a hadith being there and it being common knowledge. It wasn't common knowledge that the 12th Imam is the last Imam and he will go into occultation. We had hadith. It wasn't common knowledge, however. This is amongst the Shia, much less the non-Shia, the government. There's no sign whatsoever that the government was looking for the Mahdi, because they knew this child of the 11th Imam is going to be such and such. I don't even know if they had count of which number of Imam al-Askari was. All they knew was that there's a strong movement that Banu Hashim have led, and now it is Hassan ibn Ali who's leading it. That's all they knew and understood. They weren't very sophisticated in going and reading all of that. It's not like, in that sense, the example of Prophet Musa. In that sense, it's not similar. From another perspective, we have hadith that there's similarity between the 12th Imam and the birth of Musa, but not in the sense that Fir'aun came to know that the person who is going to get rid of him is a child born from Banu Israel. And that's why he started killing all the children and didn't want any child born, any male child. Anyhow, so if that's not the case, if it wasn't because them knowing or thinking that the 12th Imam will be the one that will remove them from power, well, the only other reason why they did that is because the movement had gotten so strong. And this is the point we're making. These are signs, this is evidence that the movement of the Ahlul Bayt had grown so strong that now they had spies in the house of the Imam to make sure that there is no male child that will live through and become the following or the next leader of the movement. This is due to the work of the rest of the Imams handing it over to Imam Hasan al-Askari, but he also led it very effectively. So when we understand this, this is a very general understanding. The specifics, what did the Imam do exactly? These are things that we have to go and study and try to understand more about. Recite a salawat, please. There are other factors to think of and to know and to cover regarding the period of the imamah of the Imam. I would like to discuss something that I feel is crucial for us to understand in this period, at this time. It has to do with preparing the ummah, preparing the Shia particularly, for the time of occultation. The preparation that the Imam had of the Shia, or for the Shia, for the period of occultation, I believe is something that will help us, or is necessary for us to know in preparation for the coming of the Imam. There's a connection there. First, let me explain briefly, I hope. I did this afternoon on an online session for another community. It took a lot longer than I expected. Hopefully we can do this in a shorter period and a shorter time tonight. Recite a salawat, please. There was a need for preparing the Shia for the period of occultation. From many aspects, one of them is from this perspective that, as I said earlier, it isn't the case that the 12th Imam being the Mahdi and being the one who goes into occultation is common knowledge. This isn't something that was the case. The Shia, for the most part, except for a few, for the most part, even amongst the elite, if we can call them that, representatives of the Imams, they did not know that the son of Imam Hasan al-Askari, which they weren't even aware was born, is going to be the last Imam and the one that will have an occultation. They didn't know that. I don't want to spend too much time explaining this. All right. I know you have questions probably regarding this, in the sense of, you know, how can that be? It's clear there's supposed to be 12 Imams. There's hadith from previous Imams. Imam al-Sadiq explained, Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen explained, the Holy Prophet mentioned. Yes, all those ahadith are there. Why was it not common knowledge? There's reasons why it wasn't common knowledge. The most important reason is that the Imams, although they mentioned it to this person or to the other person in one occasion or the other occasion, because of that we find it in books of hadith, it was not something that they repeatedly mentioned and they told others to spread this information. In other words, the Imams did not want that to be common knowledge. They didn't want it to be common knowledge. If they wanted it, it would have been common knowledge. It wasn't common knowledge. They did know that There are imams. They did know roughly, generally, about the concept of ghaiba and occultation. We know of those things. But for the average Shia to know that the son of Imam Hassan al-Askari is born and that he is the 12th imam and he is going to be in occultation, this is something that was not there. One narration that we can derive this from is about the representative of Imam Hassan al-Askari, a representative. He wasn't an ordinary average person. He was someone that represented probably Imam al-Hadi as well, but at least Imam Hassan al-Askari. He was a representative in the area of the Jibal, the mountains, which fall in current day Iran and Iraq, and he was the cities that have been mentioned in the account fall in current day Iran in Dinawar, Ardabil. These are in the province of Kermanshah and the province of Ardabil. There's a province by that name today, but the city of Ardabil and the city of Dinawar. It's a smaller town. He was a representative. 2 years after the martyrdom of Imam Hassan al-Askari, this man comes from Ardabil back to his city and he tells the people, I'm going to Samarra to figure out what is going on regarding Imamah. We know the 11th Imam has been martyred. He's passed. But what's going on with Imamah now? Who is the Imam? Who is his representative? What is happening? 2 years after the Shahada of Imam Hassan al-Askari, a representative of the Imam does not know. If a representative of the Imam doesn't know, then you can just imagine an average person doesn't know. One of the reasons why this wasn't common knowledge, that the Imam is born and that he is going to be the Mahdi and he is the one that will go in occultation, is because the government was not supposed to know. This is one instance of taqiyah, real taqiyah. Briefly, I'll also mention that we need to understand our notion of the concept of occultation is also wrong. Our understanding, our perception of the idea of occultation is that the Imam just disappeared like magic. He was there, but nobody could see him. That's something that God can do, but that's not what happened. There were, in a sense, ordinary measures, not entirely. There were some supernatural events. For example, the birth of the Imam was such that according to the account, there were no signs of pregnancy in the mother of the 12th Imam. To the extent that the night of his birth, when Imam Hassan al-Askari called for his aunt to come over for the delivery, when she came, she asked, which of these slaves is it? Imam said, it's this one. She looked at her and said, there's no sign of pregnancy. Are you sure? And he said, yes. The night came to almost an end. There were no signs she was asleep. She asked again, are you sure? And he said, yes, wait. Around Fajr time, the child was born. No sign of pregnancy. According to the hadith, the mother of Musa went through a similar experience. No sign of pregnancy. Not only in terms of size, but also the signs, the other signs in terms of health and what have you, weakness and whatever. None of those signs were there. Completely normal, but then she gave birth that night. There were some supernatural events like that, but most of what happened were measures taken to conceal the identity of the Imam. For example, when the Imam knew that they're going to assassinate him, about 6 months before that, we know that this is Rabi'ul Awwal, right? 2.5 months before this, 3 months before this is Hajj time. So about 6-7 months before his demise, he sent, Imam al-Askari sent the 12th Imam with His mother and his grandmother, in other words, the 12th Imam's mother, Imam Hassan al-Askari's wife, and Imam Hassan al-Askari's mother, the grandmother of the 12th Imam, these three were sent for Hajj, sent to Hajj, so they're not in the city. Again, the return of the Imam on the night of the Shahada of Imam Hassan al-Askari, that was not natural, that was supernatural. But the measure to send him away so that even those who know of his existence think he's not around, and that was an ordinary measure that was taken. Hiding him in the house, there's plenty of tactics that were used to make sure that those who are in the house are not aware of his presence, of his existence even. So the Imam was supposed to not disappear, or rather be there in person, but through measures like not allowing the Shia to know for his identity to be kept a secret and to be concealed. And people don't know he's there. So this is briefly explaining why the Imams did not make this common knowledge, because the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt were not supposed to know of his existence. They were already after him. His own uncle was a spy in the house to make sure he's not born. So if it's supposed to be concealed, if the Shia public, the average Shia, on a general note, are not supposed to know about this, they don't know what's coming their way, they don't know that the occultation of the Imam is coming, how do you prepare them for the occultation? There's a huge difference between having an Imam present, being able to get in touch with him, him being the leader that you follow, him having representatives in a time or a period where he's supposed to be your leader, but you don't have access to him. And then add to that, that this is going to happen suddenly. You have an Imam, he passes. Previous experiences are, when the previous Imam passes, then you have the next Imam. You identify who he is, and then you follow him. Now, without being told, suddenly there is no son. As far as people know, there's no son. There's no next Imam. But what happened with Imamah? In a sense, they're caught off guard. Going from that state to this state without even knowing it, that entire movement that we said grew so strong over the years, if measures aren't taken, the movement will be lost. How does Imam Hassan al-Askari prepare the Shia without them knowing for the occultation? What tools does he give them? What does he prepare in terms of their mindset, their understanding, and also if there's any other measures? That itself is an important study that requires many sessions and much research. I won't claim that I have enough research to tell you every single measure that Imam al-Askari has taken. There is one measure that I want to talk about. It is clear that it's there. This measure was taken by the Imam very effectively. Because of that, the movement was saved, preserved. They transitioned from the period of the presence of the Ahlul Bayt to the period of the occultation. Then that made it easier for them to transition then from the period of the minor occultation, where they have specific nawab or representatives appointed by the Imams, to a period where there's no specific representative either. Okay. The measure that I want to talk about, there are two elements in it. One has to do with training specific individuals. The other element has to do with the general public. And these two come hand in hand. The first part, which is training specific individuals, is that Imam Hassan al-Askari, salamullah alayhi, trained the two first knowledge of the 12th Imam. He trained them. Training students was something that all the Imams did. Having great students was something that some of the Imams had better students. Some of the Imams had students that were not as good. This was there. There wasn't anything new. But from what we understand from that history, the level at which they were able to train these two particular companions, Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Amri and Muhammad ibn Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Amri, the way they were able to train, he was able to train them, was at a much higher level. This isn't talking about the understanding that they have, or the knowledge they have of hadith, or the knowledge that they have of tafsir. We have plenty of students of the Ahlul Bayt. They all studied, some direct, some indirect students. They had access to all the ahadith, or to a good portion of them, or whatever. That was there. During the period of occultation, this person, this deputy, this na'ib, is supposed to be taking charge on a at least superficial scale, meaning that's the person you see, the role of the Imam. His word is going to be, every single word is going to be counted on and will have an impact, an effect that the words of other students didn't have. The Imam would always be there. People, if they hear something from this student, from the other student, and there were always differences of opinion, well, that's recorded in history, there's plenty of differences of opinion. If people would come across that, what they would do is, okay, the Imam is there, just go and ask him. Send a letter, ask a question. The Imam is there. They all have access. But from this point onwards, there's no such thing. People don't have access to the Imam. And out of all the students of the Ahlul Bayt, the scholars, this one is supposed to be the one that even the other students, the ulama, people who know a lot, they're supposed to be in touch with this individual, and whatever he says, they're supposed to trust. That's not an easy thing to do. I don't want to open up a can of worms here, but it's difficult for scholars to have a level of trust for another scholar where whatever he says, they accept. Imam Hasan al-Askari trained these two individuals spiritually, not books of hadith, not Quran, not tafsir, spiritually, to where they ascended beyond. They had certain abilities, or given certain abilities that are, in a sense, watered down versions of what the Imams themselves had. Some of the things that you've heard about some of the great scholars that we've had, great urafa that we've had, and the recent decades or last century, like Sayyid Ali Qadhi Tabatabai and Adla Bahjat, these figures, that you hear weird things about them, that they had certain abilities, that would see a person, that would know their actions. I think I've mentioned this story that Atla Bahjat was putting on amamas on Hausa students. He got to a Hausa student, he paused. And he asked him, have you studied enough for this? He said, yes, I've completed my Bahjat. I said, I don't think you have completed your studies. This is someone, he has no clue who this guy is. It was the first time he's seeing the person. He's an average person, a Hausa student, God knows where he studied. He paused and said, I don't think you've completed. Where did you get that from? How did he know? And this is small, but it's there. You've heard plenty of stories. You've heard some of them may be exaggerations. I don't know. Some of them may not be as true. But The fact is, some of that is true. Sayyid Ali Qadhi Tabatabai and others. These are names that we have heard. There's other names sometimes I have mentioned that there's plenty of signs that tell us that they were higher. That's actually what this talk is about. Inshallah, we're going to talk about that. Recite a salawat, please. These things are not created in this day and age. These were there during that time, and the Imam Hassan al-Askari trained these two specifically to a level where they had a lot of things, right? They're supposed to be taking the role of the Imam in the absence of him. There's a lot that can be said about this. This is one thing. Now, some of those abilities we're going to explain in the second point. The other thing was training of the masses, the general public, was although all of the imams now we know on different levels, different Shias, different followers of the Ahlul Bayt understand this on different levels, but it's a commonly understood concept that the Ahlul Bayt are the ones who have knowledge of the unseen to the degree, of course, that Allah has given and what He has given the Ahlul Bayt, meaning the 14 Ma'sumin, starting with the Prophet, the Lady Fatima al-Zahra, Amirul Mu'mineen, all the way to the 12th Imam. What they have of the knowledge of the unseen is beyond any other creature, any other creation. We know that it's in our sources, we understand that, ulama have talked about this. We have an understanding of that. However, this was not something that, again, was common knowledge amongst the Shia for a prolonged period of time. During the time of Amirul Mu'mineen, during the 25 years, well, you can forget about that, except for Salman, there was barely, I don't think there was anyone that understood that aspect of Amirul Mu'mineen. When he became the Khalifa, there are certain things that he spoke and he mentioned and revealed some of that to the people. Some people could take it, others couldn't take it. Different things were said. You had exaggerations about him. This is during the 5 years when he mentioned things about the people of Siffin, about Nahrawan, how it will end, who will live through it, and so on and so forth. Plenty of these examples. But still, that was not common knowledge. Some people would hear things and it was strange to them. And then for Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, again, there's not much of that. Imam Zain al-Abidin, there isn't too much of that. Imam al-Baqir, there isn't too much of that. Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi's time, the ahadith that we have show that while the Imam is trying to explain some of that to his own followers, without it becoming a problem where it becomes a political, it gives political ammunition to the Khulafa against the Ahlul Bayt, which it did. There's an interesting account of Sadir al-Sayrafi, a companion of Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Sadiq. He says that we were sitting in a public session, so there were Shias there and there were non-Shias there as well. The Imam came in the room and he said, they say we have Ilmul Ghayb. If I had Ilmul Ghayb, I would know where my slave is right now. What does that suggest to you? Obviously, you hear them, like the Imam is saying, we don't have Ilmul Ghayb. Whoever made that up has made it up. Sadir says, the session finished, the Imam left. Sadir, as a Shia, which of course he's not a very strong Shia, he's not one of those higher level students, or well, he's just an average Shia. He comes to the Imam, he says, we respect you all very much. He thinks that the Imam is getting on to them, to the Shia that were there. He says to the Imam, we respect you a lot, but we don't think that you have knowledge of the unseen. We don't think you have ilmul ghayb. Sadiq says, the Imam turned back to me. He said, have you read the Quran? He says, yes, I've read the Quran. He says, have you read the verse that says, the person who had عنده علم من الكتاب, the companion of Sulaiman, who was not a prophet, who's someone, he had ilmun min al-kitab, a partial knowledge of the book. read that, you know that story, you know that person, when he was able to bring the throne of Bilqis in a blink of an eye. All right, supernatural, obviously. Why? He had partial knowledge of the book. Which book? Not any revelation. This is about the divine book. Knowledge of the unseen. So have you read that? He says, yes. He says, have you read the other verse? That there's someone that من عنده علم الكتاب. Someone who has all the knowledge of the book. Have you read that too? Sadiq says, I said to the Imam, yes, I have read that. He said, which one has more knowledge? He says, obviously the one who has all the knowledge of the book. He says, that is us. We are the ones that have all the knowledge. You see this, the Shia, this story tells you a lot. The Shia did not understand the knowledge of the unseen. It tells you that the Imam was gradually trying to get this across. It tells you that the Imam were facing difficulty because when word got out that was used as political ammunition against the Imams, they started spreading this to say to the non-Shias, to scare them away from the Ahlul Bayt, saying that these guys claim this, and that's, oh my God, you know, that's so wrong, obviously wrong. Don't even go around this stuff. And so the Imam comes out and says this in order to go against that plot of the enemies of Islam. So the idea of the knowledge of the unseen of the Ahlul Bayt, today we generally have an understanding of that. But at the time, the previous Imams, it wasn't widespread knowledge of the Shia. And when it was talked, it was pretty basic. At the time of Imam al-Hadi, we see that the not talking about the concept, not showing knowledge of the Quran or the Sunnah of the Prophet, because that was something that had been seen, had been experienced through Imam al-Jawad. He was an 8-year-old, and Imam al-Hadi, both of them. They were both 8 years old when they became Imams. And they knew everything about the religion. That tells you this is supernatural. This is not learning something from a book, from their father or something, through classes, spending time. How could that be? However, it still doesn't hit you. Like if somebody, if you have a child here that knows a lot, we had 3-4-year-olds who had memorized the Quran. Right? You've seen some of the clips. They had memorized the Quran. You ask them about any question, they'll respond to you with a verse of the Quran. You ask them, where is this verse in the Quran? They will tell you, it's on this page. This verse number, this chapter, this juz, this page. It's in the middle of the page, or the first line, second line, whatever. All of that information. And he's only 4 years of age. You see these things, okay, some God-given talent or ability, but not supernatural. It's difficult to see that. Imam al-Hadi started showing more and more the ability of the Ahlul Bayt, their knowledge of the unseen. And then the height of it, the peak of showing this is Imam al-Askari. This is training through showing the people that there can be non-prophets, in that case Imams, who know things, God has given them that, and you can, based on that, trust them. Or one of the ways that you can identify, this is, the Imam used to, when people would go with gifts to the Imam from various regions, the Imam would tell them how much they are carrying from who? Because they would go, one person would be going, and then anywhere in that region where people would know that person, they would give them letters, gifts, khums, whatever, different things to deliver to the Imams. So they would go with bags of different things for the Imam, commodities, fabric, money, different amounts. The Imam would tell the person, you're carrying this much from this person, this much from this other person. The names of the people weren't even there. The amounts. And then sometimes they would tell The person who was coming, that you didn't bring everything. You carried one piece, you left it somewhere. They would tell that person, you left it in this particular location. Go back there. It's in the sand in this location. They would go all the way back, travel for days, and then find it exactly where the imam told them. This was done frequently. So the concept was there, but for the believers to see that this is something that can be done, and it's done frequently, they get used to it, right? They're familiar with this idea. The imam did this. Put these two together, the training of the imam, of certain companions, certain students, the first two deputies of the 12th imam, along with this culture they created, widespread or general understanding of the Shia, that the imam would give you this information. Now, the Shia have suddenly now come to a point where they don't have an imam. They haven't been told of exactly how to conduct themselves. They don't know what's going on. Who is the next imam, if any? Is there any representatives? And so on and so forth. What are they supposed to do? Well, this is what happens. The companion, we were saying, or the representative, or representatives, there's a number of them in the books that we have, Kitab al-Ghaiba of Shaykh al-Tusi and Kitab al-Ghaiba of al-Nu'mani, along with other books, Kamal al-Din wa Tamam al-Ni'mah of Shaykh al-Saduq, these different books that contain narrations and accounts of that period. There's numerous accounts. These people would go to Samirra to figure out what's going on. They would arrive there. There's multiple claims. Ja'far al-Kadhdhab is claiming to be an imam. There's different people claiming to be representatives of an imam that is unseen. Apparently he's the son of the 11th imam. These representatives didn't know. And then there are different ones. This guy says, I'm the representative. That guy says, they're the representative. How are they supposed to tell? With that training of those individuals and this culture they created, this is how they were able to identify. They would go to these different people who had those claims. Ja'far al-Kadhdhab, does he have any abilities? No. Very easy to tell this guy is not the imam. They would go and ask, can you tell me how much I'm carrying? No clue. What do you expect me? Ja'far al-Kadhdhab would respond, what do you expect me to have? Knowledge of the unseen? Like, yeah. Didn't have it. Identify, he's not the imam. He's not someone he's claiming to be. The representatives, now they didn't know they can expect that from a representative, but because those representatives had that, when they would go and try to find some signs, the person, that representative, Uthman ibn Sa'id, or his son Muhammad ibn Uthman, they would do exactly what Imam Hassan al-Askari and before that Imam al-Hadi had done. It's one of the measures that Imam Hassan al-Askari took, and through this, the trust that was gained from multiple people, especially the representatives and the ulama, that then the rest of the Shia trusted. So all these people trusting their representatives, and then the representatives trusting Uthman ibn Sa'id, and then Muhammad ibn Uthman, it led to the Shia being saved, and they didn't change direction. We didn't have at least too many people, if any, maybe a few that got lost and didn't know what's happening. But for the most part, the Shia transitioned. Now, as I said, we chose this particular part of what Imam Hassan al-Askari did, this measure taken for the transitioning of the Shia from the period of the presence of the Imams to the period of occultation, because it is relevant to us. Why is it relevant? Why is it relevant? It is relevant because we have a hadith that when the time of the coming of the Imam arrives, the people that will be close to him, the people that will be working with him, The people that will be working with him before he makes his face public and his identity public, these people have similar qualities, similar abilities. We have that in Hadith. Only a couple of references I'll give you. One is from Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi. He describes the occultations, and he says during the time of the major occultation, al-Ghaiba al-Kubra, there are those who know of the whereabouts, khassatu awliya'ih, that know the whereabouts of the 12th Imam. Imam al-Sadiq mentions this. Right. You've heard of, probably, of accounts, different ulama, urafa, great people, that got visits by the Imam. Well, they didn't know where the Imam is. The Imam would pay them a visit. When he would arrive, he made his identity known to them. They knew this is the 12th Imam. There were those that he visited frequently. There are different stories. None of that is wrong. It doesn't go against our hadith. The notion that whoever claims to have seen the Imam is a liar, that's not a correct understanding, if it's even found in that particular wording. You have to understand everything as the hadith from the Ahlul Bayt says, the same way that the Quran has muhkam and mutashabih, the words of the Ahlul Bayt also have muhkam and mutashabih. You have to add everything up and have a full and complete understanding of what the Ahlul Bayt have said. No, that isn't the case, that people cannot see the Imam. No, he made himself known, seen and known to people, different people throughout time. During the minor occultation, we have accounts. During the major occultation, we have accounts. But the accounts we have, at least the accounts themselves, tell us of the Imam visiting them, and then them knowing that this is the Imam, because the Imam revealed his identity to them in a way that they could trust that. But for them to know where the Imam lives, that's on a different level. That's a different level of connection with the Imam. Another hadith that we have is that when the Imam arrives, the companions of the Imam will look on the back of their hands and they will know what their responsibility is. Some people have tried to explain that this is technology. It has nothing to do with technology. It has everything to do with the spiritual development of the people. Now, what method it is that the Imam will tell them that they're able to, you know, they have to look in the back of their hands to get it, that's beyond me. I don't know exactly what that is. But it's not technology. It's not something that could be intercepted. It is something that is a spiritual connection, abilities that these people will have. I've been thinking about this. Alright, so we have these ahadith about this period that we are getting closer and closer to. According to some, we have already entered the period of Zuhur with explanations that I have previously given. What that actually means, yes, we don't see the Imam, but his movement is now evident. The dawn has occurred, but the sun is not visible yet. The sun will be visible when the dawn has already come. Then that's the time of the visibility of the sun himself is going to be near, very near. When we have these ahadith telling us about this period, and about these people, there's a reason why we're supposed to know there are such people. If there wasn't a reason, the Imams wouldn't tell us that this is the case. Why are we told that? It's important we know it. If this was going to be a fact that will happen, alright, it's something that will happen. Why share it with us? There's plenty of things that the Imams knew were going to happen, or will happen in the future. They didn't share that with us. They didn't share everything with us. There's certain things. What they share with us, it is important for us to know. We have to think of why this is important for us. Why is it important for us to know that there will be believers that will have these abilities, and they are connected to the Imam? This is what the hadith, the net outcome of the hadith is this. There are people who said, why are we told that? Why are we supposed to know that? You think about it. I'll explain to you what my thoughts are, and you can think about that and judge for yourself. It's up to you. Everybody's got to think about this themselves and see what makes sense to them. I'll tell you what makes sense to me. Definitely, telling people that there are such individuals is not for the purpose of telling us that if a burglar comes to your house and steals everything or a good chunk of money from you or whatever that you were hiding in your pillow or whatever, if you lose that you can go to these individuals and ask them, they'll find that for you or give you a dhikr that you'll find what you lost. And this is the type of one of the things that people would go to the likes of Adil Bajr was for that. I know of individuals who did that. In Qum, there was a brother. They robbed his house. They went to Adil Bajr and asked him for a dhikr. And he went, he did the dhikr and he was able to find it. It works, yeah. But that's not the reason why the Ahlul Bayt told us of that. That's not the purpose. That's not the objective. That has nothing to do with the coming of the Imam. The Imams have mentioned this in the context of the coming of the Imam. It's something that has to do, this knowledge of ours, of such people, has to do with the coming of the Imam. It has to do with the movement of the Imam. The more I think about it, it becomes evident to me that we are supposed to find these people. Not for finding what we have lost in terms of commodities or money or whatever, but for finding the path. During the time of fitnas, we have a lot of hadith about that as well, let's add all of these together. This is a time, right before the coming of the Imam, that there will be plenty of fitnas. When there's fitna, that means it's not clear what the direction is, what the path is, where we need to go. It's not clear. If it's not clear, we need certain people that can guide us, that can help us. Certain people that we can trust. People that their abilities of seeing what's right and wrong is beyond the ordinary. That's why the Ahlul Bayt mentioned this. And there are such people. According to the Ahadith, I just shared two of them. There's other Ahadith. If you keep looking, you'll keep seeing. There's more and more signs of that. We have got to identify them. Identify these people that have been trained, and they must be in connection with the goal of the Imam. They are moving towards the goal of the Imam. They are leading the Ummah towards the goal of the Imam, which is establishing, removing tyranny and establishing government of justice. You look around and see who's doing that. And look around and see their ability to identify the path for the believers. And over time, through our ordinary means, we don't have those supernatural abilities. Through our ordinary means, After an event is done, Amir al-Mu'mineen says, when fitna is approaching, things are unclear. But when you pass the fitna and you start looking back, things are clear. You start seeing it. The problem is, you need to see during the fitna, not afterwards. Okay. So we're not able to see. We have ordinary means and it's very difficult to see what's right and what's wrong. You get confused. We see certain people, we see the leader saying that this is the direction. This is what the enemy is trying to do. This is what we need to do. We're thinking, is this right? Is it not right? It's not clear to us. You pass the fitna, you look back and say, every single thing that was said was accurate. Not once, not twice, for 30 years. And then before him, Imam Khomeini, same thing. What do we need to do? This is the time for this move. This is the time for this move. Now it's time for me to go back to Iran. But they're going to do this, they're going to do that. Nobody agreed with Imam Khomeini and him, it being time for him to go back to the Islamic Republic, or what's currently the Islam, back to Iran. Nobody thought it's time. It's only him. Plenty of people spoke to him against it, tried to convince him against it. He said, no, this is the time. Not once, 10 years after the revolution. Is this natural? Can this be natural? Can this be ordinary? An ordinary person with their ordinary knowledge. Is this something that's possible? You have those ahadith that tell you there are such people. During that period, there will be such people. And it's in connection with the coming of the Twelfth Imam. This is what we analyze. This is deduction brings us to this conclusion. And then we're trying to identify them. We look at the goal of the Imam. We see there's certain people moving in that direction. And we see there's certain people that are leading that. And then we look at their judgment. This ability that's given, God gives, is not for fun. It's not a game. It's for the person who has this responsibility to be able to see the path clearly, to be able to help people move in that direction. And that's the purpose of that. If we're trying to identify that, you look around, I think it's hard not to tell who it is, or at least some of them who they are, because it's not just one person. But we know of this one person. We say salawat, please. I don't know, as I've said before, I try to share what I think is my takleef to share. I don't like to entertain anyone. I'm not an entertainer. I don't like that at all. And I don't think that's my job. My job is, my responsibility, meaning, is to share what I understand between me and Allah to be something that I understand Allah and the Ahlul Bayt want me to say. It is important. We're commemorating Imam Hassan al-Askari's Shahada, martyrdom. He taught those students and he taught the believers to expect from them what they saw in them, to be able to be guided by those individuals. And we are in the period, in the era of the Imam of our time. The Imam of our time, through his methods, and we don't know them. And he's not limited. He trains directly and indirectly. Read, those of you who have access, alhamdulillah, they've made documentaries about this as well. And there's books, there's documentaries with subtitles. If you're not good at reading or you're not as comfortable with reading, alhamdulillah, there's documentaries. It's just, you know, so it's easier to read subtitles about these great urafa. Some of the documentaries are about Mullah Hussein Qoliya Hamadani and his teacher, Sayyid Ali Shushtari. Go and look. look at this stuff, look at this material, and see for yourself that the amount of our time through certain individuals, this person by the name of Jula came up to Sayyid Ali Shushtari, and he again showed and gained the trust of this alim, this scholar in Shushtar, through these supernatural means. He made a judgment, Sayyid Ali Shushtari, he made a judgment, he was a judge in Shushtar. He made a judgment about a certain property. This person came to him a couple of instances. He told him, look, this is not